Okay, good morning. This is Bio 241, and what is today? Well, I got to make sure I didn't turn this recorder off. I'm going to flip it. It is the 8th of February. And let's see, we're going to finish 6, move on to chapter 3 today. Maybe you finish chapter 3. There's a couple tough concepts in chapter 3 when it comes to transcription and translation, base pairing rules, things like that. But basically, chapter 3 is just a review of anatomy for you, but we're going to spend some time on it anyway. Okay, and we're scheduled to have a test next time. But don't leave early because I don't know if we're going to get it done by next time or not. And if we, I'll have to talk to you about that. If we don't take it on Thursday, that means that we'll reschedule it for Tuesday. But that means then that the Tuesday lab group gets an extra burden because they got to have a lab and a test on the same day. Right now I have it split up so both Tuesday and Thursday have two tests. So that's a little bit unfair, but stay tuned. Does anybody have any questions over material in Chapter 6? Yeah.
I have a question. What's the format of the test?
The format of the test will be multiple choice, matching, and there might be some true-false. I'm not a really big fan of true-false, but sometimes I get to the bottom of a page when I make up a test and I only got a little space to write a question, so then I put a true-false question in there. You have examples of true-false questions in the online practice tests that you have, online practice quizzes. So make sure you know those true-false questions there. And sometimes true-false are just really tricky. They don't really test your knowledge. They're just tricky, so you got to be really careful with true-false questions. Okay. And then there's a graphical component to the test where you have to visualize maybe a flow pathway in terms of physiology, like a flow diagram of a response loop. That's really important. Maybe you have to identify chemical structures. Right? That's also important. Right? Just like the chem flash quiz that we did in class. There's a video of that online. Just practice being able to recognize all those different chemical structures. And that will help you organize a structure into a certain class of compounds, which then you understand certain activities of various compounds by their structure and chemical class. That will help you later on as well. Yes?
I was doing the practice test for chapter 2, and there was a couple on there. I can't remember, but it was like there was no formula except it wasn't the pH one. I think it was like there was a difference of 5. I don't remember. They're just going to be the log line and that
thing. Nernst equation and pH. Okay. Yeah. So you got to know how to push that log button in the right way.
It's just that one.
It's just those two.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
What GAN compound do you
use? 882E. That's in the syllabus, not the 882 LOVAS. I do not like the LOVAS. That has trouble being read by a Scantron reader. That's the form that has the bubbles shaded in already with a color. I don't know what color it is. Probably green. But just get the one that's absolutely blank. Right? And you can also get the Scantrons with line numbers, and then the answers are 1, 2, 3, 4 across. That's not the one you want either. It will work okay, but you want the ones with A, B, C, D, E, with capital letters, because that's how I write the test, with capital A, capital B, capital C. And that really helps people, for instance, maybe with dyslexia, because it's hard to tell the difference between a lowercase b and a lowercase d. You know, they just gets flipped. You don't have to do any kind of fancy manipulation. It's all uppercase letters. It's easy to see that way. Okay. And a calculator. You need a basic scientific calculator. And you cannot share calculators during the test. Like you can't share erasers, you can't share pencils, you can't share answer sheets. Can't share tests. All right? Can't share calculators either. Right? All right. Yeah. I don't think I have, you know, look for the exam study guide and see if I have any specific questions on there. I don't go over it because that kind of stuff you learned in anatomy, and maybe right now is not the time to pay particular attention to that because the test is coming up. But if you don't know that material, you're hurting yourself with your future, right? So if you don't know it, you should know it by now, okay? But look at the exam study guide to see if there's any particular questions that you should know about that, okay? Good. All right, so we were talking about equilibrium potential. We said that every cell acts as a battery because of different ion concentrations across the membrane. and that there are anions that are trapped inside the cell, and so that draws cations into the cell, right? So if there were no anions inside the cell and there was a way for potassium to move across the membrane over a long period of time, the concentration of potassium would be equal on the outside compared to the inside. But remember, opposite charges attract, so these fixed anions draw more potassium inside the cell. So at equilibrium, there's a higher concentration of potassium inside compared to the outside concentration. So you have two kinds of forces that move potassium around. You have the electrical attraction that is doing what? Which way is potassium moving according to this electrical attraction? It's moving inside, but as the concentration of potassium gets higher on the inside, then what does potassium want to do by diffusion? It wants to leave, right? So those two forces balance out, and at equilibrium, then there's no net diffusion or transport of potassium, and we're going to have a higher concentration of potassium inside the cell as a result. Okay, and most cells, all right, are at about minus 70 millivolts, but just for potassium all by itself, it produces an equilibrium potential of minus 90 millivolts. And we can calculate that using this Nernst equation right here. This tells us when those two forces are exactly balanced out. The force for diffusion, which is pushing potassium out of the cell, and the electrical attraction, which is drawing it in. So this gives the membrane voltage needed to counteract what the concentration forces and the electrical forces of those ions. So here is the equation. You don't have to memorize the form of this equation, but you do have to know how to use it and what these different symbols mean. So X just means some ion, okay, concentration outside. So these brackets just mean the concentration of this particular particle, X, like it could be potassium or chloride or calcium. And here's the concentration inside the cell. So the way that you do this, just... Well, depending on your calculator, every calculator is a little bit different, so you need some practice. But first, I would divide these two concentrations and then take the log of the result of that. All right, and then multiply it by 61 and then divide by Z. And Z is the valence of an ion. And remember, we talked about different ions having a different kind of valence, like there are some monovalent cations. How many charges do you have on a monovalent cation? Just one, and it's a positive one. So for Z, right here, we would put plus one. What's 61 divided by plus one? It's just 61, okay? But some ions are maybe a bivalent cation, which means then that it has a valence of two, but it's a positive, and then you'd have to divide 61 by two to get this number to multiply by this log function right here. Okay, so that's what we mean by valence. And if it's an anion, then of course for Z, you have to put a minus sign, so that's going to change this equilibrium potential. It's going to change the polarity of it. So make sure that you can calculate the equilibrium potential for each of these ions, sodium, potassium, chloride, and calcium right here, and using these concentrations. You do not have to memorize the concentrations across the cell membrane, but I do want you to know that these are four important ions. This will serve you well for the rest of the class, and you should know where in a resting cell, where sodium is at a high concentration. Is it outside the cell or inside the cell? You can see high outside the cell. And potassium is high inside. Chloride is high outside. And calcium is high outside. Look, it's almost zero inside the cell under resting conditions. So I do want you to know where these ions are at a high concentration and where they're at a low concentration, and be able to plug these concentrations in to the Nernst equation right here to calculate the equilibrium potential for these ions. And the Nernst equation only works for one ion at a time. And it doesn't do a really good job if you calculate the equilibrium potential for sodium, right, and write that down, and then for potassium, and then the potential for chloride, and then for calcium, and then add up all the equilibrium potentials to find out what it is in a living cell. The algebraic sum does not work very well for Nernst equation. It only works for one ion. So that's maybe a little bit confusing in this class. All right, so you got to know which ions are at a high concentration inside the cell and which are high outside the cell under normal resting conditions. Okay, so here is an example. 4. What's 5 and 150? What ion is that going to be? If you have, that's going to be 4 potassium, right? And so that gives you an equilibrium potential of minus 90 millivolts on the inside compared to the outside. For sodium, okay, because it's high on the outside, lower on the inside, the equilibrium potential is opposite that, right? And you cannot just add these two voltages together to find out what it is in a real cell, right? It just doesn't work that way. The Nernst equation only works for one ion at a time. So you can double check your calculator and see if you're calculating the numbers correctly for that, right? There's only one equation that I'll mention just in passing, which your book does not go into. If you want to consider all of these ions together acting and producing a cell membrane at one time, we need a different kind of equation called the Goldman equation, and it does not rely on the concentrations across the membrane, but actually the flow of these ions across the membrane. We call that permeability. So actually, the reason why I mention that is not that you have to know anything about the Goldman equation, but the more important thing is the movement of ions across the membrane. We call that permeability, affects the membrane potential even more so than the concentration gradient. All right, so permeability, just stick that in the back of your mind as being something really important. So every cell, when it's at rest, which means that it is not transmitting electrical information via a nerve impulse, is what we call the resting membrane potential. And in most cells, it's between minus 65 and minus 85, so sometimes we just pick minus 70 millivolts for a typical kind of cell. If it's alive, then it's acting like a battery and it produces that membrane potential. And what the heck is that, a membrane potential once again? It's just a separation of charge across the membrane. So it's relatively negative on the inside, relatively positive on the outside. That's what we mean by membrane potential. So what does that do to? RMP depends on the concentrations of ions inside and outside the cell. You could calculate for one ion what the membrane potential is according to the Nernst equation. But even more importantly, it depends on the permeability of each of these ions across the membrane. And because potassium diffuses across the membrane most easily because there are potassium channels in cells, it affects the membrane potential more than any other kind of ion because it's actually moving across the membrane. Okay. Also, some sodium enters the cell, not quite as much as potassium leaving, but some sodium enters the cell. It leaks in a little bit. All right, so that does affect the membrane potential, and it makes it a little bit less negative than the equilibrium potential for potassium. And does that make sense? If potassium moves inside the cell, can you get an impression that makes the cell what? On the inside, less negative. It becomes more positive because what's the charge of sodium? Yeah, it's a cation, right? So if a positive ion leaks inside the cell, that's going to reduce the membrane potential, right? It's going to make it more positive, or another way of saying that is that it will be less negative when it moves in. So that just kind of reinforces, right, what I said before, that permeability is really important, not just the absolute concentrations across the membrane. There is something else that adds to the resting membrane potential, and that is the sodium-potassium pump. And so you should be aware of, tell me something about a pump. What does it do? A pump? It's a way of transporting ions, but tell me something about that. What about the transport of ions? Against a concentration gradient, so it's active transport, and the sodium-potassium pump, right, is primary active transport. So to really fill in this diagram right here, you should actually draw in what? Something's missing. ATP is being broken down into ADP and inorganic phosphate since it's primary active transport, and most of the ATP that you use in your body is used up by the sodium-potassium pump and all the cell membranes. And did I ever talk about how important ATP is in your body for maintaining life? I think in this class, I don't know if I did. For instance, the organelle, and we're going to look at this in the next chapter, the organelle for making ATP inside of a cell, maybe I'm sure you all have learned this in anatomy class. What's the organelle that makes ATP? Mitochondria. In order for mitochondria to make ATP, which is the energy source that maintains our consciousness and allows for muscle to contract, right? The mitochondria needs some fuel molecules like glucose, but it also needs oxygen, right? So if you cut off the supply of oxygen to mitochondria, they won't make ATP. And then your body runs out of ATP, no living processes can take place, and then those cells are going to die. So oxygen is very important. So we can turn off oxygen supply to your brain by stopping your heart. Okay? No blood is going to go to the brain. Mitochondria don't have oxygen. How long can you maintain consciousness without mitochondria making ATP for you? Is it like 15 minutes, an hour, half a day, or what? As a matter of fact, it's right. It's only a couple seconds. It's like 2 seconds. Your brain uses up so much ATP, it no longer has energy, and you lose consciousness. That doesn't mean you're dead. You still can come back to life, because you're not dead yet, okay? But if blood flow to the brain is not restored, those cells will die because they don't have ATP running these sodium-potassium pumps right here. And if the sodium-potassium pumps aren't running, then the membrane potential disappears. The cell no longer acts like a battery. What do you call a battery that doesn't have a charge across the two terminals, like on your car? It's dead. Yeah. Same thing for cells. If there's no electrical charge, then it's a dead cell. And then once something is dead, right, it can't ever come back to life. So after blood supply is cut off to the brain, how long do you have before your brain actually dies? 2 seconds, you lose consciousness. You got a little leeway before your brain actually dies, and it is about 2 minutes. All right, so 2 to 3 seconds, you lose consciousness. 2 to 3 minutes, your brain is actually dead, cannot be revived. Under maybe some weird circumstances, we can revive somebody's brain after that period of time. Okay, so that just tells you how important ATP is for running these pumps right here. Another way to think of how important ATP is that you're pretty much a textbook body weight is about 40 kilograms. 40 kilogram person is an average weight, which is about 70 pounds, something like that. I don't know many people 70 pounds. I might have my 40 kilograms. No, 70 kilograms. 70 kilograms is an average weight. 70 kilograms. All right, now, in terms of the weight of ATP, how much ATP do you need as a fraction of your total body weight? Do you think maybe 1%, 10%? It's almost half of your body weight. You need over half. You need 40 kilograms of ATP to keep your body alive. All right, so you don't need to have like a suitcase full of ATP carrying around all day long, but as soon as ATP is broken down, right, it is what? It is rebuilt by what? Mitochondria again, right? So you don't need to have 40 kilograms at one particular time. You just need a machinery to rebuild that much because that's how much you use up. And it is this pump right here primarily that makes that uses up most of the ATP in your body. And this pump, we say, is electrogenic because it doesn't transport equal numbers of sodium and potassium across the membrane. You see, it's 2 potassium for every 3 sodium. So if this pump is working, transporting molecules from what? From low concentration to high, and that's something that you'll memorize from the previous slide. You'll know that potassium under normal living cells is low on the outside, high on the inside. But if it transports 2 cations inside the cell, but 3 cations outside the cell, can you see that helps produce the voltage across the membrane or the resting membrane potential? Right, so if you pump more positive charges on the outside, how does the outside become? It becomes more positive. If the cell is pumping out more positive charges, do you believe that 3 is bigger than 2? Absolutely, right? If it's pumping more positive charges outside the cell, the outside becomes more positive, which is exactly the same as saying that the inside becomes more negative, right? They're exactly the same kind of concept. So the sodium-potassium pump also adds to the resting membrane potential. So here is just a diagram that kind of illustrates the things that add to or contribute to the resting membrane potential. And again, these things cannot be added up just algebraically. You can't add 66 millivolts and 90 millivolts to find out what it really is inside the cell. But there are, what, fixed anions inside the cell, which makes the cell negative on the inside. There are unequal permeabilities across the membrane to potassium and sodium. That makes it a little bit more negative as well. Okay? Then the sodium-potassium pump makes the membrane potential, again, because there's higher potassium on the inside, higher sodium on the outside. right? So there's an uneven distribution of ions. So if we just look at the membrane potential according to the Nernst equation, we get minus 90 millivolts for potassium and plus 66 for sodium. We can't just add the Nernst equation numbers together to get minus 70. You also have to know that some other things are happening across the cell membrane, namely the sodium-potassium pump, and then some what we call leak channels that allow for the permeability of these ions, and it all settles out to be about minus 70 millivolts for a typical cell. And if that voltage goes away, just like the battery in your car, what happens to that cell? It's dead. Okay. So that's something that we're going to look at, especially when we get into neurophysiology. So we're interested in permeability, the sodium-potassium pump, right? And that's going to be important to consider. All right, let's talk about cell signaling. How do cells communicate with each other? The structural and functional unit of communication between cells, at least cells that are close together, maybe even touching each other, is what we call a synapse. And there are two kinds of synapses. There is an electrical synapse, right? So when two cells are very close to each other, electrical signal can go from one cell into the neighboring cell, signaling that cell to do something. That's what we call an electrical synapse. These kinds of synapses are rare, but very important, right? The second kind of synapse is what we call a chemical synapse. And the chemical synapse is the more ubiquitous, and it means that there has to be a chemical that is released by one cell that is then picked up by the second cell, and information is transmitted across that junction by a chemical. So we call that a chemical synapse. So let's look at first an electrical synapse. One way that we can change the electrical activity of a cell. So here we have a diagram of two cells. There's one on top and there's one here down on the bottom. Here we see an extracellular space. Here we see an intracellular space, cytoplasm in the cell down below it. We can change the electrical property of the cell on the top by allowing an ion to move in. Let's just say all of a sudden, let's just consider at rest. Where is sodium at a high concentration at rest? Outside the cell. So what does it like to do? By concentration gradient, it likes to enter the cell, right? Just by the concentration gradient, because it's high outside, low inside. Also, the inside of the cell is negative, and what is that going to do for the movement of sodium inside the cell? Does sodium want to move in because of the electrical gradient as well? What can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract each other. So sodium is dying to get inside the cell because the concentration gradient will pull it in, as well as the electrical gradient will pull it in. And when sodium enters the cell right here, what happens to the electrical property of this cell? The inside of the cell gets less negative or more positive, right? So that is what we call a stimulation. This cell becomes stimulated when sodium enters because it loses that charge. All right, now sodium really can't move across this membrane because, remember, sodium is hydrophilic. It likes to be in water. And what can you tell me about this inner layer of the membrane? It is a hydrophobic region, which means polar molecules like ions can't move across. So sodium can only move across when certain channels or pores open up. So it can't hop, that electrical signal can't go from one cell to the other unless there's a special tunnel between these two membranes that allows sodium to move from one cell into a second cell. So if sodium becomes high in the top cell over here, right, and this cell here has low sodium and is still negative, sodium will move into the second cell through this, what we call a gap junction. It's a channel through two membranes that sodium can diffuse across. And when sodium moves into this cell right here, what happens to the electrical property of cell number two? It becomes less negative, more positive, which is a stimulation for a second cell. All right, so that's an electrical way for cells to stimulate each other when sodium can move through gap junctions. So if you have an organ that needs to function as a unit, to be excited as a unit, then it has gap junctions. So there are some examples for smooth muscle. There are very few examples for neurons, but a really good example would be the myocardium. What the heck is the myocardium? It's the heart. The heart should contract as a unit, right? You shouldn't have one side contracting and then the other. You shouldn't really have just the top part and then a minute later the bottom part. It should contract as a unit to force blood into arteries. And so if one cell in the heart becomes stimulated by an inflow of calcium. That signal then will move from one cell to the next through gap junction so that every cell in the myocardium becomes stimulated, which then leads to contraction as a unit. Okay, now gap junctions we don't have between skeletal muscle, and you'll see why that's a really good reason. Because if you stimulate your biceps over here to contract, all right, you don't want any other muscle in your body contracting, right? If when your biceps contracted, if electrical signals traveled through every skeletal muscle in your body, what would happen to reach out and grab this Pepsi right here? Every muscle in your body would contract, right? You would not have any kind of coordination. So a different kind of synapse has to be used for skeletal muscle, not electrical synapses, and that would be a chemical synapse. Okay, so the second kind of synapse is a chemical synapse. All right, so chemical synapses respond to a chemical signal. The target cell must have a receptor protein in the cell membrane for that signaling molecule, and the shapes of the receptor have to match up with the shape of the signaling molecule. They have to be complementary. Right, so a triangular-shaped signaling molecule won't bind to a receptor protein that's circular on the cell membrane. It doesn't have the right shape. So sometimes we rely on the hand-and-glove model or the lock-and-key model, saying that a signaling molecule and a receptor have to be complementary in shape in order for binding to take place. And binding is necessary to transmit information. All right, so in paracrine signaling, cells secrete regulatory molecules that diffuse to nearby cells, right? And then they have to bind to a receptor, which then causes some change in physiology of these cells that have receptors to them. And if it's a muscle cell, guess what that muscle cell, how is the muscle cell going to respond? By shortening or contracting when it binds a signaling molecule. So here I have a couple basic questions. What must a target cell contain in order to respond to a signal molecule? It's got to have a receptor. So just kind of think of what you need in order for you to perceive light. You need a photoreceptor, right? So in order to perceive some kind of signal, you need a receptor, right? What must be the shape of the binding site of the paracrine receptor? It's got to be complementary to the signaling molecule so that they can form a complex together. Okay, so here is a pretty good example of a typical kind of signaling scheme. Your book calls it synaptic, right? I call it a chemical synapse. Here is a neuron that transmits electrical information over these short processes that we call dendrites down through the cell body and then into an axon. The nature of that electrical signal changes pretty amazingly once it gets into the axon, but nonetheless, it's an electrical signal that travels very fast down the axon. When it gets to the axon terminus, that electrical signal can't hop from the nerve into a muscle right here. It just can't, because there's just too much resistance. You would need like a lightning bolt, right? And we don't have lightning bolts in our body. So that electrical signal gets converted into the release of a chemical that we call a neurotransmitter, because this is a neuron, and it's going to transmit that information to the skeletal muscle via this chemical, which we call a neurotransmitter. Some neurotransmitters have specific names. Neurotransmitter is just a general name. Maybe you've heard of some specific names of neurotransmitters, like maybe acetylcholine, norepinephrine, serotonin are chemical compounds that are secreted by neurons that will stimulate nearby cells. One example would be this muscle as being an effector cell. So electrical information doesn't move across. Chemical information moves across in the form of a neurotransmitter, which changes then the physiology of the cell. Muscles would be what? To contract. That's a really good way to think of that. So the signal changes form from electrical to chemical across the signal and then back again to an electrical signal. So the way the whole skeletal muscle gets excited from end to end is that it now allows an electrical signal to flow over the whole cell membrane. So information is transmitted electrical through the neuron. Across the synapse, it's a chemical signal, and then that signal is transmitted within a muscle fiber as an electrical signal, once again. So it goes electrical, chemical, electrical for a chemical synapse. All right, so what must be the shape of the binding site of the neurotransmitter receptor right here? If it's acetylcholine, it's got to have the complementary shape to acetylcholine. But if it has, if the receptor right here has a complementary shape to norepinephrine, what effect will acetylcholine have on this effector cell? It will be blind to it. It won't change the physiology in this cell whatsoever, right? The shapes of these molecules have to match up. Okay, another scheme for signaling, endocrine signaling, is that here we have a cell that's producing a product, and it secretes it into the extracellular space, so we have a high concentration of signaling molecule in the extracellular space, and it moves by diffusion into the cardiovascular system. Now, what kind of blood vessel is this where diffusion can take place?
Capillary.
A capillary, and you should know why that is. And that's, okay, because capillaries are specialized for exchange because they're thin membranes. And some of the cells are kind of leaky. They have maybe even pores. Remember, there's three different kinds of capillaries. But arteries and veins are way too thick to allow for diffusion. Capillaries are thin. So this signaling compound gets in the blood, and where does it go after that? Everywhere where the blood goes, maybe to another capillary, and then it can move by diffusion, once again, through the capillary to this target tissue. And what does this target tissue have to have in order to be a target tissue? It's got to have a receptor for that signaling compound, which is what? Somehow complementary in shape to the signaling molecule. So if we have a system like this, we have cells secreting a product, not into a duct, but it's picked up directly by the vascular system. This is what we call an endocrine signaling system, right? What would we call a system that is actually secreting a product into a duct? That would be exocrine. So you should know the basic definition of exocrine versus endocrine. So this is endocrine because the cardiovascular system distributes that signaling compound, and only certain cells are what we call target tissues because they have a receptor. Okay. There are two different schemes of receptors based on what the nature of the signaling molecule is, if it's hydrophilic or hydrophobic. And remember, that is going to determine whether the signaling molecule can move across the membrane or not. What kind of molecules can move across the cell membrane? Nonpolar, right? Hydrophobic molecules, because the basic nature or the simple nature of every cell membrane is what? The phospholipid bilayer with this big lipid region on the inside of it, right? The interior space is a very large hydrophobic region. All right, so hydrophobic regulatory molecules can actually diffuse across the cell membrane, and they bind to receptors that are inside the cell. All right, so does that make sense that hydrophobic molecules can move inside the cell? So you don't have receptors for them on the outside because they can enter the cell. They don't need any special kind of handling or anything. But here are our receptors inside the cell. These kinds of receptors that are inside the cell usually act, okay, by stimulating or controlling protein synthesis. And that begins here in the nucleus. So the signaling molecule binds to a receptor. Then this complex moves into the nucleus and it initiates protein synthesis. All right, so then this cell produces different kinds of proteins that changes the physiology of this cell. We're going to look at a lot of different kinds of examples of this particular mechanism right here. So some hydrophobic regulatory molecules are steroids, steroid hormones. What kind of molecule is a steroid? Is it a sugar, a protein, a lipid, or a nucleic acid? It's a lipid, right? And lipids can, of course, diffuse through the cell membrane. So steroids bind to cytoplasmic receptors. The same thing for thyroid hormones. They can dissolve in lipids, so they can move through the cell membrane, bind to cytoplasmic receptors. And here is a strange kind of neurotransmitter right here, nitric oxide, that can enter cells and then change the physiology inside the cell. All right, so hydrophobic is what? Cytoplasmic receptor. Now, if we have hydrophilic molecules, okay, many kinds of molecules are like that, like insulin is a signaling compound. Acetylcholine, norepinephrine are hydrophilic. What does that mean in terms of diffusing across the cell membrane if they're hydrophilic? They're excluded from the cell. They can't get into the cytoplasm. The membrane will exclude them. So in order to communicate inside the cell, it has to have what? A cell membrane receptor or an extracellular receptor on the cell membrane. So polar regulatory molecules bind to cell surface receptors. All right, so there are proteins embedded in the membrane that have a receptor site on the outside of the cell. And again, this receptor site has to be complementary in shape to the signaling molecule. For instance, a square molecule wouldn't bind to this particular receptor. It wouldn't fit in the active site, the binding site. Okay, so this is a good target tissue because here is the receptor. So the molecule that's trapped outside the cell is what we call the first messenger. When it binds to the receptor, there are other things that can happen inside the cell because this receptor protein goes all the way across the cell membrane and it can cause changes inside the cell. It can produce other kinds of messengers inside the cell. All right, so we have a first messenger and second messenger. On this slide, you should be able to tell me, where do we always find a first messenger? It's outside the cell. Where are we always going to find a second messenger? Inside the cell, and these messengers cannot move across the cell membrane. They never do, but they are linked together by what? These receptor proteins within the cell membrane. Okay. All right, so here are some second messengers. You've heard of calcium before. Where do you think calcium is important? What's an important function of calcium in your body? That's right. You've had anatomy. That's right. We talk about muscle contraction. That's right. For muscles to contract, you need calcium, right? You just don't need bones. As a matter of fact, calcium in bones is just a reservoir for calcium. You need calcium in other places, which are much more important than bones, right? Because it acts as a second messenger inside cells. Cyclic AMP, which is a breakdown product or conversion product from adenosine triphosphate, right? Here's a cyclic adenosine monophosphate. So here is an adenosine with just one phosphate group. Two of the phosphates have been cleaved by what kind of process breaks down molecules that you've learned about? A hydrolysis reaction, right? So if you hydrolyze ATP, one thing that could be made is cyclic AMP, and then that can become a signaling molecule inside the cell. Other kinds of second messengers that we're going to look at are G proteins, because instead of using adenosine, it uses guanosine triphosphate. And here are a couple other signaling molecules that can build up inside the cell, which carries information inside the cell. This is diacylglycerate, or we just call it DAG, or inositol 3-phosphate, and I just call that IPI3. Right? So DAG and IPI3 can be second messengers. So where would you find all of these compounds going up and down in concentration? Inside the cell, and their concentration inside the cell changes as a result of what? A first messenger binding to a cell surface receptor. Without a first messenger binding to a cell surface receptor, the concentrations of these things don't change and therefore can't signal any kind of change inside the cell. Okay, so G proteins is a very important kind of receptor mechanism which takes information from outside the cell and injects it inside the cell. All right, so it's an important second messenger pathway. It's what we call a highly conserved transduction pathway in that all organisms pretty much have these G proteins. No matter how evolutionary ancient they are or old they are or unsophisticated, they have these kinds of systems for transferring information from outside the cell to inside the cell. Okay, so they contain three subunits. You could call it 1, 2, and 3, but they're actually called alpha, beta, and gamma. And you'll see the Greek letters for these things. The receptor is on the surface. Remember, for a second messenger system, the first messenger can't get inside the cell, so the receptor is going to be on the cell surface. And then it becomes activated, and that activated subunit then can change activity of an ion channel or maybe an enzyme, which then changes the activity or the physiology of the cell. So here we have the scheme, and this is a nice exam figure for how a G protein works. So here is the receptor, and the receptor, you can see, spans the whole membrane. The binding site is extracellular, and what does the binding site bind? First messenger, right? And that's a regulatory molecule secreted by some other organ that's trying to control this cell right here. All right, so it binds. And this protein on the intracellular side has these proteins that have these three subunits. These three subunits become activated when the alpha unit can bind a guanosine triphosphate. All right, and Guanosine triphosphate you should think of as ATP, just a little bit something structurally different than ATP. But what really is ATP? It's a source of energy which can cause conformation changes or certain kinds of activity within the cell. So when GTP binds to the alpha unit, right, this G protein can become activated so that when the first messenger binds, these subunits can disassociate from the receptor protein. Right? Gamma and beta always stick together. Alpha breaks away from itself. And now these things can diffuse along on the surface, the inside surface of the membrane. They don't diffuse inside the cell. They're kind of stuck to the membrane. But remember, one model of the cell membrane is what? The fluid mosaic model. These molecules are moving around all the time. It's a very fluid system. Okay, so this alpha and beta unit can diffuse around in the cell membrane, and it can bump into another protein that is embedded in the cell membrane. This, for instance, maybe could be an ion channel. And when it bumps, okay, since it has this stored energy in it, it can either open or close an ion channel. Right, that's like poking you in the side. It's going to cause some kind of conformation change in this protein right here, which then will allow ions now that can't move across the membrane to move across the membrane. So if this is a sodium channel, what's going to happen to sodium? Where is it high? On the outside. So by diffusion, it wants to enter. But also don't forget, what's the charge on the inside of the cell? It's negative. Sodium is positive. That's also going to cause sodium to rush inside the cell, changing the electrical properties of the cell. Okay, so that's one possible thing. This alpha subunit might diffuse around on the inside surface of the membrane, bump into another, a different kind of, instead of a channel, it could be a channel, but let's just say maybe it's an enzyme, which then can catalyze various reactions inside the cell, right, which is going to change activity inside the cell. So it could be ion channels, for instance, or enzymes changing the physiology of the cell on the inside. So the first messenger is having an effect inside the cell by activating and allowing this G protein to diffuse around and bump into other kinds of proteins. And then after these proteins take their effect, the G protein is released and they bump into each other again at this receptor protein, and right when that happens, GTP is broken down, and then this has to be recharged with a GTP molecule. And this process can happen over and over again as long as you have a first messenger. So what is happening right here is that you're taking information from outside the cell and converting it into information inside the cell. We call that a signal transduction. Right, so it's a way of taking information from the outside to the inside of the cell. It's transducing this information from outside to inside the cell. So G proteins are very important signal transduction pathway. All right, so this is an exam figure, so make sure you know that these three subunits are right here and that these effectors can produce changes in the physiology inside the cell because this G protein is a second messenger that becomes activated when what happens? A first messenger binds to the receptor protein. Now, here's a good question. This regulatory molecule for a G protein, what's the nature of that regulatory molecule? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Hydrophilic or hydrophobic? I would say hydrophilic because it can't get through the cell membrane. If it was hydrophobic, it could get through the cell membrane, and there's no reason to have what? A receptor on the cell membrane. You could have an intracellular or a cytoplasmic receptor. So this molecule is the first messenger is excluded from the cell because it is hydrophilic. It likes to be in water, does not like to be in lipid. Okay, is that sort of making sense? Okay, so second messenger systems work for hydrophilic signaling molecules. That is just one kind of second messenger. What are some others? Oh, calcium is a good one. DAG, IPE3 are good, and cyclic AMP. Those are good second messengers, which we'll become a lot more familiar with in the other parts of the class. All right, so that's it for this chapter right here. Okay, make sure you can label this diagram right here. So the energy molecule that drives this system is GTP, not adenosine triphosphate. Hence, they come up with the name of G proteins for this signal transduction pathway. because it runs on GTP, which is a similar kind of molecule. When it's hydrolyzed, it releases about the same amount of energy as ATP when it's hydrolyzed as well. Okay, I want to see a question. Anybody questions on this chapter right here? Yes. Oh, yeah. The valence. It's the magnitude as well as the direction. It's the positive and negative, whether it's a cation or an anion, and then the magnitude of the charge.
So calcium
would be 2. Plus. That's right.
Equation Z would be 2 plus.
Exactly right. Let me pull that slide up. I think I'm not too far away from that right here. Okay, so for calcium, how would you work this Nernst equation? You got the valence for Z. What's the valence for calcium? It is plus 2. So put a plus 2 for Z, so it would be what, just 61 divided by 2, okay, to calculate the equilibrium potential. Okay, I don't have any really good examples of minus 2 of bivalent anions, but there are numerous bivalent cations. Magnesium is another one. That's another important. I don't know. I forgot how that goes. You should. I forgot if I'm asking you to know some monovalent and divalent ions.
Basically, you would just know the four that.
I think that's a good place to start. Okay. These four right here: monovalent, 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 bivalent. That's a good one to start with. Okay. Or maybe I'll tell you what it is on the exam. Okay. I don't want you to have to know that detail of a periodic table, but you could tell from a periodic table. I'll give you the formula. You have to know how to use it. Okay. So I'll even give you the 61. Okay. And then I'll tell you the concentrations on the outside, inside, and then you got to know how to plug it in. Okay. And then use your log function right there. Okay. Fantastic. Okay. So let's move on to next chapter. Let me change my pointer options right here. Okay, so we're interested in the cell. So what's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? The synapse. Got two general kinds. You got electrical, that allows sodium currents to go from one cell to the other. When sodium enters a cell, that's what we call a stimulus, or it can be a chemical synapse. And if it's a chemical synapse, then there has to be receptors someplace. Receptors on the cell surface, if it's a hydrophilic signaling molecule, receptors that are cytoplasmic, if it's a hydrophobic signaling molecule. Okay, so structural and functional unit is very important for you to understand. And so I'll ask you, what's the structural and functional unit of life? Is life a really complicated thing? Life is very complicated, but to help understand that, you got to break it down into its basic components, and the structural and functional unit is a cell. All right, so if you're concerned whether a process or something is alive or not, it's got to be made out of cells. Right? And if it's not made out of cells, then it is not a living system. So what does it mean to be a cell? First thing, it's got to have a plasma membrane around it, number one. Number two, it's got to have cytoplasm. Okay, and cytoplasm is the fluid part inside the cell, cytosol plus organelles. Right? And it also has to have genetic material, things that can be passed on from generation to generation. It's got to have those three things. So human compartments, like this beast right here, is a cell because it's got what? Plasma membrane, and it's got cytoplasm, and it's got genetic material on the inside. Bacteria have a cell membrane. They might also have a protein coat on the outside, but it's got a cell membrane along with that protein coat. It's got cytoplasm. It doesn't have organelles, but it has all the living processes dissolved in cytosol. And it has a chromosome. It has genetic material. It's just not inside of a nucleus. All right, so bacteria certainly is a living system because it has a plasma membrane, cytoplasm, and genetic material. There are other things that maybe are a little bit confusing, like a virus. Is a virus alive or not? Okay, and well, let's look at that basic definition. I hear a lot of correct answers. A virus does not have a cell membrane. It has a hard protein coat. Right? It does not have cytoplasm, but it does have genetic material. It's got one out of the three. And is that any good for life?
No.
No. So a virus is not alive. So when you get a viral infection, sometimes that's a very difficult kind of infection to treat compared to a bacterial infection. Bacteria sometimes are easy to treat because you can kill a bacterium because it's alive. But can you kill a virus? You can't kill a virus because it's not even alive to begin with. Right? So that's why viruses can be typically a lot more dangerous. Okay. So this could be an exam figure, and it's just not anatomy. Just don't memorize the different structures. Like here, you know, this is mitochondria. Since this is physiology, you got to know what the function is of each of these organelles. Right? So that's really what you have to know from this chapter. And I could just start talking about some of these organelles. Like mitochondria right here. It makes ATP. Okay? And then we have things like rough endoplasmic reticulum. It kind of looks like sandpaper right here because it has membranes, but it also has ribosomes attached to it. So its function is due to these ribosomes right here, which is protein synthesis. So that's the level that you got to know these things. Have some good bullet points for the function of each of these organelles. Here's some endoplasmic reticulum right here, but it does not contain ribosomes, so it cannot make a protein. That because a ribosome is a workbench for protein synthesis, it does synthesize important biomolecules, namely lipids. So lipid synthesis for smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And your book is really interesting because it calls it, what, agranular versus granular. This is the only place where I've heard that terminology. But it makes perfect sense, right? It's not confusing. Okay. There's a cytoskeleton inside the cell made up of microtubules and microfilaments. And these can attach to certain components of the cell membrane, right? And it can push and pull the cell membrane to give the cell a certain kind of shape. So those are what we would call peripheral proteins. So microtubules and microfilaments are involved with motility of somehow or another within the cell or maybe even outside the cell. I'll talk a little bit more about that. So here we have this cell membrane. We've got the basic phospholipid bilayer, and that's very fluid. All right, so if you drop a little oil or something on a glass of water, what happens to that oil? Does it sink to the bottom, float on the top, or whatever? What happens to it? It just sits right on the top, and if you jiggle the glass of water, what happens to that oil layer? Does it fracture and break like ice, or what happens to it? It just jiggles right on the surface of water. It's very fluid, just like the water underneath it. Okay, so that's one understanding of the plasma membrane. Don't forget this big hydrophobic region on the inside. These are made by what kinds of compounds? Fatty acids, right? Because that's a nice phospholipid right here. To give some stability to the membrane, it can incorporate cholesterol molecules, which gives the membrane a little rigidity. That's really handy so that when you stand up, all your cell membranes don't just dribble down on the floor, right? So cell membranes need some stability. And something else that stabilizes the membranes are proteins that can dissolve. So what can you tell me about the amino acids in this protein that are just in this region right here? It has side chains that are made from substitutions that are hydrophobic, right? More organic type compounds right in this region. And then on this tip of the protein and this tip of the protein over here, it has amino acids that are hydrophilic, right? They have substitutions in that one position that are hydrophilic, so it likes to be in water. So this protein can span the membrane. This is what we call an integral protein. In order to get this protein out, we'd actually have to destroy the membrane. These integral proteins can have many different kinds of functions. They can act as channels, and those channels can be opened and closed by things that are happening inside the cell that allow transport of material across the cell. It could be a pump, for instance, like a sodium potassium pump. So it could be a transporter and not just a channel. It can also be an enzyme that's going to change the chemistry inside the cell. It can have binding sites for signaling molecules, so it could be a receptor protein. And notice that some of these proteins are conjugated or joined to these little globs right here, which are sugar molecules. So this can be a sugar protein or a glycoprotein, and the shape of this sugar molecule is an identifier that identifies the cell as belonging to your body. So every cell in your body will have the same shape of this sugar molecule so that your body knows this cell belongs to you. And if you get a cell from somebody else or a different organism, the shape of this identifier sugar will be different, and so then it will be recognized by the immune system, and then what is your immune system going to do to this cell? It's going to attack it and hopefully destroy it. And maybe it's even a cancer cell, for instance, where this antigen has a little bit different shape. Then your immune system can identify it and kill that cancer before it becomes a problem. And we've probably all had cancer. Some of us are, and most of us, our immune system is smart enough to identify it and destroy it. And every once in a while, unfortunately for some people, the person's immune system can't recognize a cancer cell and therefore doesn't destroy it in time, and it causes problems later on. So a better and more sophisticated understanding of the phospholipid bilayer is what we call the fluid mosaic model for a membrane. The basic structure is just the phospholipid bilayer, but remember, in a living cell, you have a lot of other things that are added to the membrane. That's what we call the mosaic part of the membrane that give a lot of particular function to the plasma membrane. So think of the plasma membrane as being a very special kind of organelle inside the cell. And the plasma membrane can be moved by the microtubules and microfilament system inside the cell. And the thing that coordinates these microtubules and causes them to move the cell around are the centrioles. The centrioles organize the cytoskeleton and then direct the motion of the cytoskeleton for either moving organelles around inside the cell or even actually changing the shape of a cell, or even maintaining the shape of a cell. What kind of shapes are you familiar with? Are you familiar with cuboidal? Probably. What's another shape? Squamous. What's another shape? Columnar, right? So centrioles then coordinate the microtubules within those cells to give them that particular kind of shape, or change their shape in the sense of this shapeshifter right here, which is undergoing phagocytosis. It's surrounding this particle right here with these pseudopods or false feet, and then it's going to form a vesicle around, for instance, if this were a bacteria, and now the bacteria will be inside the cell, and then it can be destroyed. Okay, so phagocytosis. What's an English way of saying phagocytosis? Cell eating. Is that active or passive? It's an active process, right? It requires ATP. Okay. And I think we talked about bulk transport before. Generally speaking, if things are brought inside the cell, large particles, we call that endocytosis. And if it is moving large particles outside the cell, that is exocytosis. And if it's a particle, we call it phagocytosis, like right here. But if it's just fluid in this compartment that the cell is ingesting, then we call that pinocytosis, right? Nonspecific intake of solutes that are in solution. Okay, exocytosis via secretory pathways. We have some cell surface specializations that I don't even think I see on that cell diagram, but we have cilia, flagella, and microvilli. They have microtubules inside of them, okay, to give them a particular shape, but also it changes the shape very radically of a cilia. So cilia can beat or sweep on the surface of the cell, and that can cause flow over the surface of the cell. Other unicellular organisms use cilia to actually swim around in their environment. None of our cells really swim around by cilia, okay? But some cells in human bodies can move around by using a flagellum, okay? And there's one cell in particular you're probably all familiar with, a sperm, that has just a single flagellum, so it can swim around anywhere where there is fluid. A microvilli is a lot smaller than a cilia, so flagella is very large, cilia is relatively small, and microvilli are even much smaller than cilia. Microvilli don't move around. Okay, they're important for increasing the surface area of the cell membrane for absorption. And the surface area you should think as the doorway for exchange. As the doorway gets bigger, how many people can move through a doorway as it gets bigger at the exact same time? As the size of the doorway increases, the number of people increases as well. Right? So microvilli increase transport across the cell membrane. Okay, so here's what cilia look like, and I think that's a pretty good discussion for these surface specializations. Other kinds of organelles. Don't forget, cytoplasm is made of the cytosol and organelles together. Here's a cytoskeleton. It's coordinated and controlled by centrioles, which I don't see on this diagram right here, but there are various things within the cell that move around within the cytoplasm because they can attach themselves to microtubules, and microtubules then will give them a ride to different parts of the cell. And you should think of a microtubule as being like a monorail. It's a railway system inside the cell, but it's a monorail. It doesn't have two tracks, it just has one. And that shouldn't be too strange a concept, because where could you go really close and hop on a train that only has one track? Like Disneyland has a monorail, right? So a monorail is a really good example. All right, but in order, just like at Disneyland, in order for that monorail to move around, what does it need? It needs energy. Yeah, it needs a track, but it needs energy just by placing these molecules and organelles around inside the cell. All right, that requires ATP to do that. All right, so what are some other important structures? I see some other ribosomes inside the cytosol right here that are just not attached to a membrane. They're important for protein synthesis, but the fate of these proteins are different than the fate of proteins made by rough ER. The proteins made by free ribosomes stay inside the cell. Proteins made by rough ER are then transported by vesicles to a Golgi complex, which then kind of bids the question, what the heck is the function of a Golgi complex? It receives proteins from rough ER, and it modifies and packages. So two words, modification and packaging for this structure right here. It might conjugate it with a carbohydrate, might conjugate it with a lipid molecule, might make a glycoprotein out of it. A good example would be mucus. Mucus is that stuff that runs out of your nose when you have a cold, which is what? Really slippery. So mucus sometimes is used for lubrication, but it also protects linings from damage, like the lining of your stomach. And mucus that comes out of your nose even has lysozyme in it, all right, which is an enzyme that can digest proteins. All right, so then that protein moves from the rough ER to the Golgi, and then by a vesicle into a secretory vesicle, hops a ride on a microtubule, and it can fuse to the plasma membrane and is exocytosed outside the cell. So rough ER, Golgi, secretory vesicle right here is what? Just a secretory pathway, proteins made by these ribosomes attached to rough ER. Free ribosomes, the proteins stay inside the cell to perform their activity. So here you can see maybe the end of a secretory pathway. I see a vesicle fusing to the plasma membrane, and that kind of maybe looks like exocytosis, but it could also represent what? Endocytosis. I don't see an arrow pointing one way or the other. I see some other vesicles inside the cell. Like here is a lysosome. Lysosome is an intracellular digestive system. It has enzymes called lysozyme that can hydrolyze large molecules. So if a bacterium is phagocytized, then that vesicle will fuse with a lysosome. A lysosome then will digest the bacteria, and then it can't be infectious anymore. But those antigens are still there, so the cell might actually learn how to identify that bacteria as being foreign and develop an immune response to it. Another kind of vesicle that we have, where do we have another kind of vesicle? Here's a secretory vesicle. Do you see a peroxisome on here anywhere? Peroxisome is another important kind of vesicle, similar to a lysosome. Its function is sort of breaking things down. It can detoxify compounds that are toxic inside the cell. So for lysosome, it is digestion. For a peroxisome, it is detoxification, a little bit different kind of chemical process. But it is both degrading dangerous compounds that enter the cell. And then there's a third kind of vesicle that your book doesn't talk about until later on. And, I don't have a slide right here. It's called an endosome. I think I have a slide in here someplace. I just don't know where it is at the moment. An endosome. An endosome is important for routing, okay, and for the following reason. Let's go back to this slide. Here we have the plasma membrane. What's the very basic, simple structure? What could you use to describe a plasma membrane? Phospholipid bilayer. What is a very basic description of this membrane that's making this lysosome? It is a phospholipid bilayer as well. Okay, so the nature of this membrane on a lysosome is exactly the same as the plasma membrane. So when they bump into each other, they can just fuse together very nicely because they're the same material. You no doubt have seen that, seen this when kids are playing with some soap bubbles, right, with a little jar, they make big soap bubbles. Sometimes when soap bubbles touch each other, bump into each other, they snap and break apart. But other times, if they touch each other just right, what happens? They just fuse together to make one big bubble because the soap film is identical, right? The same thing for the cell membrane. So if it's an endosome right here, it can fuse to the cell membrane, but don't forget the fluid mosaic model. There can be special functions dissolved in the membrane of an endosome, maybe for transport, which can transport things from extracellular to intracellular, but if it's inside the cell, it can't do its job. But if that endosome attaches itself to the plasma membrane, now you have the transporters in the plasma membrane, and then all of a sudden the cell has the ability to what? Allow for transport of those molecules across the membrane. And which is really handy because it might take a long time to build those transporters by protein synthesis, but it will only take a matter of seconds to take an endosome and put it in the cell membrane right here. Otherwise, it might take weeks to build those transporters. So it's a very fast regulatory mechanism to change the properties of the cell membrane. Okay, so sometimes I just call that routing for an endosome. Mitochondria, function for ATP. Now, it has an outer membrane. It's got an inner mitochondrial membrane. The inner mitochondrial membrane form Christi, right, has all these folds right here. There's an intermembrane space. So we're going to find some fascinating things out about a mitochondria and what it's doing. A mitochondria also has its own chromosome. And it has living cytoplasm on the inside of it. And then what else does it have? It has genetic material, it's got cytoplasm, and what does it have on the outside? A cell membrane. So you should actually consider this mitochondria here as being what? It's alive, it's a cell. And that's exactly what we now know to be true, and we call that the endosymbiont theory. This was probably a bacteria, it looks very much like a bacteria that infected a cell that looked very much like a human cell at one point in time. And then that precursor human cell and mitochondria learned to live together. And they have evolved together to where now that human cell cannot live without mitochondria and mitochondria cannot live outside of a human cell. All right, so that happened by evolution. So we are actually a symbiosis of organisms. Here is just one example of that. Mitochondria control their own rate of replication, and they control their own metabolic activity. Now, what does the human cell get from mitochondria? That's pretty obvious. It gets energy in the form of ATP. That seems awfully expensive. I'd like to find a gas station that would just give me ATP if they didn't demand a lot of me. But what does this mitochondria get out of the deal? It's giving energy away. It's getting oxygen, okay? And probably even more importantly, it's getting protection. We have, humans have very sophisticated immune system that protect these mitochondria from predation, from viruses and other bacteria that would like to consume them. So it's a nice symbiotic relationship. Okay, and when we say theory, what does that mean? It's been backed up by all kinds of different kinds of experiments by different labs all over the world, and there's no contradictions to the evidence. Ribosomes, that's the workbench for protein synthesis. How did that happen? Well, guess what? There's no way we can have a test on Thursday, because the hardest part of the chapter is still coming up. So that means that you get another weekend to study for the test. All right, so chapter, what was it? The previous chapter was 6. That's a relatively rough chapter. Some people have a really hard time with chemistry. Okay, if you don't have a chemistry background, then you really have to apply yourself to chemistry. And if you haven't had biology, then the last part of this chapter can be a little bit difficult too. So how do you get over these difficulties? Work the end of chapter questions, the online questions, right? And reading certainly helps. And just use the study guide to prepare for the test. There's all kinds of interesting drag and drop exercises as well. All right, so you know where we're going to start next time? Talking about ribosomes. And yeah, unfortunately, we'll finish this chapter up pretty fast, but we can't finish it today. So if you know somebody that was not in class today, you got to let them know. I'll send an email out to everybody, but sometimes you don't check your email. But you got to check your email, which means what? You got to have an active email address into Blackboard, otherwise I can't reach you. That's very important. So Tuesday, the exam will be on Tuesday. And also tell them to listen to the lecture. I did record it today.